Okay, I can't really see if there are any cars coming, but that's cool. This big truck gets to hang here and do big truck stuff.
Just a guess. But there should be other
ways. Let's hear what this dude has to say.
Parties can work together to improve economic security. Say a hard-working American loses his job. We shouldn't just make sure that he can get unemployment insurance. We should make sure that program encourages him to retrain for a business that's ready to hire him. If that new job doesn't pay as much, there should be a system of wage insurance in place so that he can still pay his bills. And even if he's going from job to job, he should still be able to save for retirement and take his savings with him. That's the way we make the new economy work better for everybody. I also know Speaker Ryan has talked about his interest in tackling poverty. America is about giving everybody willing to work a chance, a hand up. And I'd welcome a serious discussion about strategies we can all support, like expanding tax cuts for low-income workers who don't have children. But there are some areas where we just have to be honest. It has been difficult to find agreement over the last 7 years. And a lot of them fall under the
shit
category of what role the government should play in making sure the system's not rigged in favor of the wealthiest and biggest corporations. And it's an honest disagreement. And the American people have a choice to make. I believe a thriving private sector is the lifeblood of our economy. I think there are outdated regulations that need to be changed. There is red tape that needs to be cut. There you go.
Yeah. Fuck yeah! High five, motherfucker! Shotgun some beers.
But after years now of record corporate profits, working families won't get more opportunity or bigger paychecks just by letting big banks or big oil or hedge funds make their own rules at everybody else's expense.
Cut all this red tape. Let's do even less work.
Because
get rid of the regulation. I just want to hang out.
Collective bargaining to go unanswered. Food stamp recipients did not cause the financial crisis. Recklessness on Wall Street did. Immigrants aren't the principal reason wages haven't gone up. Those decisions are made in the boardrooms that also often put quarterly earnings over long-term returns. It's sure not the average family watching tonight that avoids paying taxes through offshore accounts. The point is, I believe that in this new economy, workers and startups and small businesses need more of a voice, not less.
That voice comes from Bitcoins. Let's talk about it.
And I'm not alone in this. This year I plan to lift up the many businesses who figured out that doing right by their workers, or their customers, or their communities ends up being good for their shareholders. And I want to spread those best practices across America. That's a part of a brighter future. fact, it turns out many of our best corporate citizens are also our most creative. And this brings me to the second big question we as a country have to answer. How do we reignite that spirit of innovation to meet our biggest challenges? 60 years ago, when the Russians beat us into space, we didn't deny Sputnik was up there. We didn't argue about the science or shrink our research and development budget. We built a space program almost overnight, and 12 years later, we were walking on the moon. That spirit of discovery is in our DNA. America is Thomas Edison and the Wright brothers and George Washington Carver. America's Grace Hopper and Katherine Johnson and Sally Ride. America is every immigrant and entrepreneur from Boston to Austin to Silicon Valley racing to shape a better future. That's who we are. And over the past 7 years, we've nurtured that spirit. We've protected an open internet and taken bold new steps to get more students and low-income Americans online. We've launched next-generation manufacturing hubs and online tools that give an entrepreneur everything he or she needs to start a business in a single day. But we can do so much more.
With bitcoins. Let's talk about it.
Last year, Vice President Biden said that with a new moonshot, America can cure cancer. Last month, he worked with this Congress to give scientists at the National Institutes of Health the strongest resources that they've had in over a decade. Well, tonight I'm announcing a new national effort to get it done. And because he's gone to the mat for all of us on so many issues over the past 40 years, I'm putting Joe in charge of mission control.
You're sending Joe Biden to space?
We've all lost. For the families that we can still save, let's make America the country that cures cancer once and for all. What do you say, Joe? Let's make it happen.
What do you say, Joe? I don't know, dude.
Now, medical research is critical. We need the same level of commitment when it comes to developing clean energy sources. Look, if anybody still wants to dispute the science around climate change, have at it. You will be pretty lonely because you'll be debating our military, most of America's business leaders, the majority of the American people, almost the entire scientific community, and 200 nations around the world who agree it's a problem and intend to solve it. But even if the planet wasn't at stake, even if 2014 wasn't the warmest year on record, until 2015 turned out to be even hotter, why would we want to pass up the chance for American businesses to produce and sell the energy of the future?
President Obama speaking in the House chamber, delivering his State of the Union address.
Oh, thanks for that. Okay.
7 years ago, we made the single biggest investment in clean energy in our history. Here are the results. In fields from Iowa to Texas, wind power is now cheaper than dirtier conventional power. On rooftops from Arizona to New York, solar is saving Americans tens of millions of dollars a year on their energy bills and employs more Americans than coal, in jobs that pay better than average. We're taking steps to give homeowners the freedom to generate and store their own energy. Something, by the way, that environmentalists and Tea Partiers have teamed up to support. And meanwhile, we cut our imports of foreign oil by nearly 60% and cut carbon pollution more than any other country on Earth. Gas under $2 a gallon ain't bad either. Now we've got to accelerate the transition away from old, dirtier energy sources. Rather than subsidize the past, we should invest in the future, especially in communities that rely on fossil fuels. We do them no favor when we don't show them where the trends are going. And that's why I'm going to push to change the way we manage our oil and coal resources so that they better reflect the cost they impose on taxpayers and our planet. And that way we put money back into those communities and put tens of thousands of Americans to work building a 21st century transportation system.
Now, Joe Biden's going to lead the charge. Teleportation. Let's hear it. What do you think, Joe?
It's going to happen overnight. And yes, there are plenty of entrenched interests who want to protect the status quo. But the jobs we'll create, the money we'll save, the planet we'll preserve, that is the kind of future our kids and our grandkids deserve. And it's within our grasp. And climate change is just one of many issues where our security is linked to the rest of the world. And that's why the third big question that we have to answer together is how to keep America
safe.
Who
stole my meatball sandwich? I was right here.
Or trying to nation build everywhere there's a problem.
The third big question about security.
I told you earlier, all the talk of America's economic decline is political hot air. Well, so is all the rhetoric you hear about our enemies getting stronger and America getting weaker. Let me tell you something. The United States of America is the most powerful nation on Earth. Period.
And I will fuck you up if you say otherwise. I will stab you, man! The president!
It's not even close. It's not even close. We spend more on our military than the next eight nations combined. Our troops are the finest fighting force in the history of the world. No nation attacks us directly or our allies because they know that's the path to ruin. Surveys show our standing around the world is higher than when I was elected to this office, and when it comes to every important international issue, people of the world do not look to Beijing or Moscow to lead, they call us. It's useful to level set here. Because when we don't make good decisions. Now, as someone who begins every day with an intelligence briefing, I know this is a dangerous time. But that's not primarily because of some looming superpower out there, and it's certainly not because of diminished American strength. In today's world, we're threatened less by evil empires and more by
evil robots.
The Middle East is going through a transformation that will play out for a generation. rooted in conflicts that date back millennia. Economic headwinds are blowing in from a Chinese economy that is in significant transition. Even as their economy severely contracts, Russia is pouring resources in to prop up Ukraine and Syria, client states that they saw slipping away from their orbit. And the international system we built after World War II is now struggling to keep pace with this new reality. It's up to us, the United States of America, to help remake that system. And to do that well, it means that we've got to set priorities. Priority number one is protecting the American people and going after terrorist networks. Both Al-Qaeda and now ISIL pose a direct threat to our people because in today's world, even a handful of terrorists who place no value on human life, including their own, can do a lot of damage. They use the internet to poison the minds of individuals inside our country. Their actions undermine and destabilize our allies. We have to take them out. But as we focus on destroying ISIL, over-the-top claims that this is World War III just play into their hands. Masses of fighters on the back of pickup trucks, twisted souls plotting in apartments or garages, they pose an enormous danger to civilians. They have to be stopped. But they do not threaten our national existence. That is the story ISIL wants to tell. That's the kind of propaganda they use to recruit. We don't need to build them up to show that we're serious. And we sure don't need to push away vital allies in this fight by echoing the lie that ISIL is somehow representative of one of the world's largest religions. We just need to call them what they are, killers and fanatics, who have to be rooted out, hunted down, and destroyed. And that's exactly what we're doing. For more than a year, America has led a coalition of more than 60 countries to cut off ISIL's financing, disrupt their plots, stop the flow of terrorist fighters, and stamp out their vicious ideology. With nearly 10,000 airstrikes, we're taking out their leadership, their oil, their training camps, their weapons. We're training, arming, and supporting forces who are steadily reclaiming territory in Iraq and Syria. If this Congress is serious about winning this war and wants to send a message to our troops and the world, authorize the use of military force against ISIL. Take a vote. Take a vote. But the American people should know that with or without congressional action, ISIL will learn the same lessons as terrorists before them. If you doubt America's commitment, or mine, to seeing that justice is done, just ask Osama bin Laden. Ask the leader of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, who was taken out last year, or the perpetrator of the Benghazi attacks, who sits in a prison cell.
I guess you actually could ask
him. When you come after Americans, we go after you. and it may take time, but we have long memories, and our reach has no limits. Our foreign policy has to be focused on the threat from ISIS and Al-Qaeda.
They're going to ride the no-limit tank into Syria.
Can't stop there. For even without ISIS, even without Al-Qaeda, instability will continue for decades in many parts of the world. In the Middle East, in Afghanistan, parts of Pakistan, in parts of Central America and Africa and Asia. Some of these places may become safe havens for new terrorist networks. Others will just fall victim to ethnic conflict or famine, feeding the next wave of refugees. The world will look to us to help solve these problems. And our answer needs to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. That may work as a TV soundbite, but it doesn't pass muster on the world stage. We also can't try to take over and rebuild every country that falls into crisis, even if it's done with the best of intentions. That's not leadership. That's a recipe for quagmire, spilling American blood and treasure that ultimately will weaken us. It's the lesson of Vietnam. It's the lesson of Iraq, and we should have learned it by now.
You're listening to the NPR special coverage at the State of the Union address.
Fortunately, there is a smarter approach. A patient and disciplined strategy that uses every element of our national power. It says America will
present.
Alone if necessary.
Sergeant Slaughter!
Our people and our allies. But on issues of global concern, we will mobilize the world to work with us and make sure other countries pull their own weight. That's our approach to conflicts like Syria, where we're partnering with local forces and leading international efforts to help that broken society pursue a lasting peace. That's why we built a global coalition with sanctions and principled diplomacy to prevent a nuclear-armed Iran. And as we speak, Iran has rolled back its nuclear program, shipped out its uranium stockpile, and the world has avoided another war. That's how we stop the spread of Ebola in West Africa. Our military, our doctors, our development workers, they were heroic. They set up the platform that then allowed other countries to join in behind us and stamp out that epidemic. Hundreds of thousands, maybe a couple million lives were saved. That's how we forged a trans-Pacific partnership to open markets, to protect workers and the environment, and advance American leadership in Asia. It cuts 18,000 taxes on products made in America, which will then support more good jobs here in America. With TPP, China does not set the rules in that region. We do. You want to show our strength in this new century? Approve this agreement. Give us the tools to enforce it. It's the right thing to do. Let me give you another example. 50 years of isolating Cuba had failed to promote democracy. It set us back in Latin America. That's why we restored diplomatic relations, opened the door to travel and commerce, positioned ourselves to improve the lives of the Cuban people. So if you want to consolidate our leadership and credibility in the hemisphere, recognize that the Cold War is over. Lift the embargo. point is, American leadership in the 21st century is not a choice between ignoring the rest of the world, except when we kill terrorists, or occupying and rebuilding whatever society is unraveling. Leadership means a wise application of military power and rallying the world behind causes that are right. It means seeing our foreign assistance as a part of our national security, not something separate, not charity. When we lead nearly 200 nations to the most ambitious agreement in history to fight climate change, yes, that helps vulnerable countries, but it also protects our kids. When we help Ukraine defend its democracy, or Colombia resolve a decades-long war, that strengthens the international order we depend on. When we help African countries feed their people and care for the sick, it's the right thing to do, and it prevents the next pandemic from reaching our shores. You know, right now, we're on track to end the scourge of HIV/AIDS. That's within our grasp. And we have the chance to accomplish the same thing with malaria, something I'll be pushing this Congress to fund this year. That's American strength. That's American leadership. And that kind of leadership.
And then the signal went dead.
Working to shut down Guantanamo. And it only serves as a recruitment brochure for our enemies. There's a better way. And that's why we need to reject any politics. Any politics that targets people because of race or religion. This is not a matter of political correctness. This is a matter of understanding just what it is that makes us strong. The world respects us not just for our arsenal. It respects us for our diversity and our openness and the way we respect everything. His Holiness Pope Francis told this body, from the very spot that I'm standing on tonight, that to imitate the hatred and violence of tyrants and murderers is the best way to take their place. When politicians insult Muslims, whether abroad or our fellow citizens, when a mosque is vandalized, or a kid is called names, that doesn't make us safer. That's not telling it like it is. It's just wrong. It diminishes us in the eyes of the world. It makes it harder to achieve our goals. It betrays who we are as a country.
How many of you heard this one before?
Our Constitution begins with those three simple words. Words we've come to recognize mean all of the people, not just some. Words that insist we rise and fall together. And that's how we might perfect our union. And that brings me to the fourth and maybe most important thing that I want to say tonight. The future we want, all of us want, opportunity and security for our families, a rising standard of living, a sustainable, peaceful planet for our kids, All that is within our reach. But it will only happen if we work together. It will only happen if we can have rational, constructive debates. It will only happen if we fix our politics. A better politics doesn't mean we have to agree on everything. This is a big country. Different regions, different attitudes, different interests. That's one of our strengths, too. Our founders distributed power between states and branches of government and expected us to argue, just as they did, fiercely, over the size and shape of government, over commerce and foreign relations, over the meaning of liberty and the imperatives of security. But democracy does require basic bonds of trust between its citizens. It doesn't work if we think the people who disagree with us are all motivated by malice. It doesn't work if we think that our political opponents are unpatriotic or are trying to weaken America. Democracy grinds to a halt without a willingness to compromise, or when even basic facts are contested, or when we listen only to those who agree with us. Our public life withers when only the most extreme voices get all the attention. And most of all, democracy breaks down when the average person feels their voice doesn't matter, that the system is rigged in favor of the rich or the powerful or some special interest. Too many Americans feel that way right now. It's one of the few regrets of my presidency that the rancor and suspicion between the parties has gotten worse instead of better. I have no doubt that a president with the gifts of Lincoln or Roosevelt might have better bridged the divide. And I guarantee I'll keep trying to be better so long as I hold this office. But my fellow Americans, this cannot be my task or any president's alone. There are a whole lot of folks in this chamber, good people, who would like to see more cooperation, would like to see a more elevated debate in Washington, but feel trapped by the imperatives of getting elected, by the noise coming out of your base. I know, you've told me. It's the worst kept secret in Washington. And a lot of you aren't enjoying being trapped in that kind of rancor. But that means if we want a better politics, and I'm addressing the American people now, if we want a better politics, it's not enough just to change a congressman or change a senator or even change a president. We have to change the system to reflect our better selves. I think we've got to end the practice of drawing our congressional districts so that politicians can pick their voters and not the other way around. What a bipartisan victory. I believe we've got to reduce the influence of money in our politics so that a handful of families or have interest in bankroll our election. And if our existing approach to campaign finance reform can't pass muster in the courts, we need to work together to find a real solution. Because it's a problem. And most of you don't like raising money. I know. I've done it. We've got to make it easier to vote, not harder. We need to modernize it to the way we live now. This is America. We want to make it easier for people to participate. And over the course of this year, I intend to travel the country to push for reforms that do just that. But I can't do these things on my own. Changes in our political process, in not just who gets elected, but how they get elected, that will only happen when the American people demand it. It depends on you. That's what's meant by a government of, by, and for the people. What I'm suggesting is hard. It's a lot easier to be simple. To accept that change is not possible. And politics is hopeless. And the problem is, all the folks who are elected don't care. And to believe that our voices and our actions don't matter. But if we give up now, then we forsake a better future. Those with money and power will gain greater control over the decisions that could send a young soldier to war, or allow another economic disaster, or roll back the equal rights and voting rights that generations of Americans have fought, even died to secure. And then, as frustration grows, there will be voices urging us to fall back into our respective tribes, to scapegoat fellow citizens who don't look like us, or pray like us, or vote like we do, or share the same background. We can't afford to go down that path. It won't deliver the economy we want. It will not produce the security we want. But most of all, it contradicts everything that makes us the envy of the world. So my fellow Americans, whatever you may believe, whether you prefer one party or no party, whether you supported my agenda or fought as hard as you could against it, our collective futures depends on your willingness to uphold your duties as a citizen, to vote, to speak out, to stand up for others, especially the weak, especially the vulnerable. Knowing that each of us is only here because somebody, somewhere, stood up for us.
You're listening to NPR Live Special Coverage.
We need every American to stay active in our public life, and not just during election time. So that our public life reflects the goodness and the decency that I see in the American people every single day. It is not easy. Our brand of democracy is hard. But I can promise that a little over a year from now, when I no longer hold this office, but as Americans first, bound by a common creed, voices Dr. King believed would have the final word. Voices of unarmed truth and unconditional love. And they're out there, those voices. They don't get a lot of attention. They don't see a lot of fanfare. But they're busy doing the work this country needs to do. I see them everywhere I travel in this incredible country of ours. I see you, the American people, and in your daily acts of citizenship, I see our future unfolding. I see it in the worker on the assembly line who clocked extra shifts to keep his company open, and the boss who pays them higher wages instead of laying them off. I see it in the dreamer who stays up late at night to finish her science project, and the teacher who comes in early, maybe with some extra supplies that she bought, because she knows that that young girl might someday cure a disease. I see it in the American who served his time, made bad mistakes as a child, but now is dreaming of starting over. And I see it in the business owner who gives him that second chance. The protester determined to prove the justice matters. And the young cop walking the beat, treating everybody with respect, doing the brave, quiet work of keeping us safe. I see it in the soldier who gives almost everything to save his brothers. The nurse who tends to him until he can run a marathon. The community that lines up to cheer him on. It's the son who finds the courage to come out as who he is. And the father whose love for that son overrides everything he's been taught. I see it in the elderly woman who will wait in line to cast her vote as long as she has to. The new citizen who casts his vote for the first time. The volunteers at the polls who believe every vote should count. Because each of them, in different ways, know how much that precious right is worth. That's the America I know. That's the country we love. Clear-eyed, big-hearted, undaunted by challenge, optimistic that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. That's what makes me so hopeful about our future. I believe in change because I believe in you, the American people. And that's why I stand here as confident as I have ever been that the state of our union is strong. Thank you. God bless you. God bless the United States of America.
And you're listening to live special coverage from NPR News of the President's State of the Union Address. I'm Audie Cornish, and we just heard President Obama wrap up there. And for some analysis now of the President's speech, which just ended a few minutes ago, we're going to welcome some guests here in the studio. First, Eliana Johnson. She's Washington editor of the National Review. Hey there, Eliana.
Hi, Audie.
And E.J. Dionne of the Washington Post and Brookings Institution. Hey there, E.J.
Good to be with you, Audie.
And, of course, our NPR national political correspondent, Mara Liasson, is here. She's going to help us kind of decipher what we just heard. And, Mara, I don't know what's more revealing here, what was said or what wasn't.
I think what was revealing was what was said. Yes, we didn't hear much about gun control. I mean, that's something that kind of has been occupying the president's time recently, and it didn't play a big role in the speech at all. But I thought it was a very comprehensive defense of the president's agenda and what he's been trying to do, and a very detailed rebuttal to the criticisms of him and to the conversation about America that's happening on the Republican campaign trail. He didn't mention any candidates by name, but he certainly almost quoted them verbatim. He says, the world will look to us to help solve some problems, and our answers need to be more than tough talk or calls to carpet bomb civilians. He talked about, over and over again, he said that we need to reject any politics that targets people because of race or religion. Obviously, he's talking about Donald Trump's proposal to temporarily ban Muslims from entering this country.
And we should note that we are expecting to hear shortly from the South Carolina Governor, Nikki Haley. She's going to be giving the GOP's response to the president, response to the State of the Union address. And so I don't know if I want to turn to Eliana now, maybe. What does Nikki Haley have to do in a speech like this?
You know, these rebuttals have typically been more interesting, actually, I think, than the State of the Union addresses. They've offered people identified as rising Republican stars the chance to either prove that they have the mettle to succeed or really to fail, and many of them have actually failed. But I think you're going to see Nikki Haley try to define the direction of her party. And I expect to hear some notes of bipartisanship, in particular a rejoinder to Donald Trump, some of what we got from President Obama, and some knocks at the Republican Party's leadership. but she's somebody who's talked about as a potential vice presidential nominee, and this is a huge opportunity for her as she comes onto the national stage, really for the first time tonight.
You talk about Republican leadership, and that makes me want to bring in a guest from the House Republican Party. We have Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State. She's the chair of the Republican Conference. Congresswoman McMorris Rogers, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Great to be with you.
So you're familiar with these moments ahead of a response, right, that Governor Haley has to do. You gave the Republican remarks in 2014. After hearing the president's speech tonight, what would you say in response?
Well, I am really excited to hear Governor Nikki Haley lay out a choice for the country. And as we head into 2016, clearly, America has a choice to make as to whether they want to continue the policies, the direction that President Obama has laid out, or if they want to look at a choice that the Republicans want to bring forward this year that is really one about empowering people and giving people greater opportunities. And it is our intent as we head into this year to present those specific policy solutions. And I believe that what you'll hear tonight from Nikki is some of those specifics that she was going to be presenting.
Now, usually in a speech like this, we listen for a few, maybe olive branches to the opposition party. Did you hear anything from President Obama, whether it's say that expanding tax cuts for low-income workers without kids, or maybe passing the Trans-Pacific Partnership Bill, something that you feel like House Republicans will be able to work with him on?
Well, yeah, I do think that we are committed in keeping this country safe, and the focus on taking the steps necessary to ensure that Americans all across this country feel safe and secure. And with the growing threats that we face around the world, that is going to be a priority. I was excited, pleased to hear him make the commitment to curing cancer once and for all. And in the House, we've led an effort on 21st century cures.
In the House.
That is looking at what is it going to take to bring new breakthroughs to market quicker. And that has been a priority of us. We led the effort in increasing the research dollars at NIH, but also looking at the processes. So often it's our government processes that have made it difficult to bring those new products to market. And in fact, more and more of those clinical trials are being done in overseas.
Although for the listener at home, they may find it odd that of all the proposals, curing cancer was the one that he found potentially where there could be cooperation and maybe easiest to do.
Well, I think that's a bipartisan, well, it's certainly a huge task, but one in which we as Republicans, Democrats, and independents can join in saying, you know, that we should.
Yeah, hey, we should take care of that cancer.
America has led the world in the last 50, 60 years when it comes to breakthroughs, medical innovation, healthcare breakthroughs, and we want to continue to do that.
You know, the president really tried to emphasize this idea of optimism, feeling that he's drawing a line between sort of his agenda and his approach and the 2016 Republican field of candidates. How do you feel about that assessment? Do you feel like Republicans right now are just down on the country?
You know, I think that the Republicans want to offer a brighter America, more opportunities, greater opportunities for everybody in this country, no matter who you are, no matter where you've come from.
These are not great non-answers. These are bad non-answers.
Year. America definitely is a big election year. They have a choice to make. And you're going to see us putting forward policies related to growing our economy, rethinking the poverty programs. 50 years after the effort to end the war on poverty, the rates are basically the same. We believe that we can do better. We can give every person more opportunities.
I was just going to ask, Republicans in the House are actually going to head to their own retreat where you're going to kind of rally around some of these ideas. What kind of response do you want to see? What do you think is going to be the kind of lead issue into that?
Well, it is an important time. Over the next few days, the House and Senate Republicans will be gathering. We will be having in-depth conversations about each of these policy priorities that we have. We are committed to moving forward, to showing what we are for, being solution-oriented and focusing on that choice that we want to offer the country heading into 2016. So often we hear from the president, it's really the top-down government knows best policies that are driven out of Washington, D.C., and we believe that it's we need to we trust individuals to make better decisions for themselves, communities, and we want to be providing policies that are going to really, from the bottom up, give people greater opportunities. And that's what we'll be discussing and presenting to the country.
That's Kathy McMorris Rogers of Washington State. She's the chair of the Republican Conference. Congresswoman McMorris Rogers, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I just want to turn briefly here in the studio. Mara, I don't know what you could sort of hear from McMorris Rogers in terms of opportunity to reach across the aisle.
Well, it was a pretty bipartisan statement there. She wasn't full of, strong opposition to the president. She did talk about a couple areas where they could work together. I think that the White House is hopeful that on TPP, the big Asia-Pacific trade agreement, they could get something, an overhaul of the criminal justice system. She didn't mention that specifically. She liked the cure for cancer.
Right. Although that is the president, right? He didn't get too deep into his criminal justice reform ideas.
No, he didn't get too deep. But I think there are some areas. I think that what you heard from her was that this House Republican conference, led by the new young speaker, Paul Ryan, wants to be not just an opposition Congress. They want to have their own ideas. They want to have an alternative agenda of their own. And that means that they can't just be locked in a cage match with President Obama.
EJ Deal, jump in here.
Yeah, I think there are several things he did in this speech. One, as you suggested when you talked to the Congresswoman, some of it was just an antidote to the Republican campaign. He, without mentioning Trump by name, there were lines here that clearly referred to him, those who claim we could slam the brakes on change, promising to restore past glory if we just got some group or idea threatening us under control. And there was a resolute optimism. Yes, he acknowledged all the problems people face, but he said the idea that we aren't doing better than any other economy in the world is wrong. I think the second thing he did that was really important is he has not given, I think, a clear and robust defense of his own foreign policy. I think he did that tonight. And he was a preacher at the end. And he sounded a bit like Gandhi or King. He spoke of unarmed truth and unconditional love.
E.J. Dionne, thank you so much. I want to mention and remind people, we expect to hear shortly from South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She's going to be giving a response to the State of the Union speech. In the meantime, we're going to bring in House Majority Whip Steve Scalise. He's a Republican from Louisiana. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Hi, great to be with you.
Now, people, I mentioned this earlier to Congresswoman McMorris Rogers about olive branches. Did you hear any specifics, any one or two agenda items from this president that you feel in an election year the House might take up?
Well, criminal justice reform is something that's already been moving in the House with a bipartisan group supporting getting something done. If you look at a lot of the other elements of the speech, there weren't many specifics. Really, it was a lot of kind of rambling, fake straw man where the president was trying to set up these false choices and really, I don't think, really gave a uniting speech in a way that he could have in this final year of his presidency.
You're saying straw man meaning sort of his digs or depictions of Republicans?
Yeah, on so many fronts, he tried to act as if you're against this health care bill, you're not for health care for people, even though you see millions of people losing the health care they hadn't liked because of his law. If you hear him talk about this, almost this corporate boogeyman all the time. He's, all these decisions made in corporate boardrooms that are hurting people, when in fact, it's every small business I've talked to in Southeast Louisiana, and my colleagues hear the same thing. The small businesses that are struggling in all of the districts all across this country, most of the struggle they're having hiring people, creating more middle-class jobs, are due to the radical regulations coming out of the Obama administration.
And of course,
he said he acts like they're evil and they're just interested in profits, when in fact they're trying to hire more people. And the president's own agenda is making it harder for him.
The president will be traveling to your home state on Thursday, right? He'll be in
Baton Rouge. That's right, on Thursday he'll be in Baton Rouge.
And you can bet he'll probably be talking about health coverage, right? The state has a new Democratic governor, his reverse course from his predecessor, Dan, Medicaid. Is this a situation where Republicans will essentially, say in your state, have to defend whether or not the president's moves have actually helped people there?
In my own district, I've gotten copies of cancellation letters for people who have lost the good health care that they had, that they were promised by the president they could keep. And look, in terms of Medicaid expansion, I think everybody in the medical community acknowledges the most broken form of health care is Medicaid. Most doctors don't even take Medicaid. And so to suggest that by putting tens of thousands more people on Medicaid in a state like my home, Louisiana, many of these people are going to be people that currently have health insurance where they can actually take their kid to their own doctor. They're going to now be forced to go to an emergency room to get primary care because of the broken forms of Medicaid. The president should work with us to fix those things that don't work in his health care law and try, instead of trying to double down and act like it's not a problem,
of course,
just keep moving forward.
This does underscore the idea of alternatives. Speaker Ryan says he wants to go from being an opposition party to a proposition party. What does that mean for you?
What it means is bringing more bold ideas onto the House floor, passing them to the Senate, hopefully getting those bills to the president's desk to solve real problems, to get the economy moving, to get spending under control in Washington, to show an alternative health care law where patients would be back in charge of their health care decisions and costs would be lowered as to the reverse, which is what we're seeing.
That's House Majority Whip Steve Scalise, Republican from Louisiana. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
Great being with you.
And now we're hearing from South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley. She is set to, she's about to give the response to the President's State of the Union speech.
So fuck that guy. Click. All right. That was her response.
Rising star. Mara, maybe you can talk to us about her. People whisper vice president potential. How real is that?
Definitely on the vice presidential chattering list right now.
Eliana, is that a long list?
Well,
I'm Nikki Haley, governor of the great state of South Carolina. I'm speaking tonight from Columbia, our state's capital city. Much like America as a whole, our state has a rich and complicated history, one that proves the idea that each day can be better than the last. In just a minute, I'm going to talk about a vision of a brighter American future.
But first,
I want to say a few words
about this fine jewelry.
Who just gave his final State of the Union address.
It's made of diamondique, and
Barack
you can call
Obama's
right now.
President 7 years ago broke historic barriers
QL
and inspired millions of Americans. As he did when he first ran for office, tonight President Obama spoke eloquently about grand things. He's at his best when he does that. Unfortunately, the president's record has often fallen far short of his soaring words. As he enters his final year in office, many Americans are still feeling the squeeze of an economy too weak to raise income levels. We're feeling a crushing national debt, a health care plan that has made insurance less affordable and doctors less available, and chaotic unrest in many of our cities. Even worse, we are facing the most dangerous terrorist threat our nation has seen since September 11th. And this president appears unwilling or unable to deal with it. Soon the Obama presidency will end, and America will have the chance to turn in a new direction. That direction is what I want to talk about tonight. At the outset, I'll say this. You've paid attention to what has been happening in Washington, and you're not naive. Neither am I.
She sounds like she has a gun to her head.
And many of your frustrations are my frustrations. A frustration with a government that has grown day after day.
She sounds like she's reading something that she did not write.
Yet doesn't serve us any better. A frustration with the same endless conversations we hear over and over again. A frustration with
in theaters three, Star Wars, The Force Awakens, playing at 7.
We need to be honest with each other.
9:15.
And with ourselves.
10:45.
While Democrats in Washington bear much responsibility for the problems facing America today, they do not bear it alone. There is more than enough blame to go around. We as Republicans need to own that truth. We need to recognize
yes,
our
own the truth
to the erosion of the public trust.
The truth is
in
something you can
leadership.
Totally own.
We need to accept that we've played a role in how and why our government is broken. And then we need to fix it. The foundation that has made America
home improvement theme
best
starts
hope
playing.
On earth hasn't gone anywhere. It still exists. It's up to us to return to it. For me, that starts right where it always has. I am the proud daughter of Indian immigrants, who reminded my brothers, my sister, and me every day how blessed we were to live in this country. Growing up in the rural South, my family didn't look like our neighbors, and we didn't have much. There were times that were tough, but we had each other, and we had the opportunity to do anything, to be anything, as long as we were willing to work for it. My story is really not much different from millions of other Americans. Immigrants have been coming to our shores for generations to live the dream that is America. They wanted better for their children than for themselves. That remains the dream of all of us. And in this country, we have seen time and again that that dream is achievable. Today, we live in a time of threat like few others in recent memory. During anxious times, it can be tempting to follow the siren call of the angriest voices. We must resist that temptation. No one who is willing to work hard, abide by our laws, and love our traditions should ever feel unwelcome in this country. At the same time, that does not mean we just flat out open our borders. We can't do that. We cannot continue to allow immigrants to come here illegally. And in this age of terrorism, we must not let in refugees whose intentions cannot be determined. We must fix our broken immigration system. That means stopping illegal immigration. And it means welcoming properly vetted legal immigrants, regardless of their race or religion, just like we have for centuries. I have no doubt that if we act with proper focus, we can protect our borders, our sovereignty, and our citizens, all while remaining true to America's noblest legacies. This past summer, South Carolina was dealt a tragic blow. On an otherwise ordinary Wednesday evening in June, at the historic Mother Emanuel Church in Charleston, 12 faithful men and women, young and old, went to Bible study. That night, someone new joined them. He didn't look like them, didn't act like them, didn't sound like them. They didn't throw him out. They didn't call the police. Instead, they pulled up a chair and prayed with him for an hour. We lost 9 incredible souls that night. What happened after the tragedy is worth pausing to think about.
Did they pray too hard?
Our state was struck with shock, pain, and fear. But our people would not allow hate to win.
Like, say it.
We didn't have violence, we had vigils. We didn't have riots, we had hugs. We didn't turn against each other's race or religion. We turned toward God and to the values that have long made our country the freest and greatest in the world. We removed a symbol that was being used to divide us, and we found a strength that united us against the domestic terrorist and the hate that filled him. There's an important lesson in this. In many parts of society today, whether in popular culture, academia, the media, or politics, there's a tendency to falsely equate noise with results. Some people think that you have to be the loudest voice in the room to make a difference.
All right. I'm home. It's fantastic to be home. Everybody have a good night, and do your thing. See ya.